Today, news from Afghanistan. On the eastern coast, a suicide bomber has killed a U.S. soldier. Outside Kabul, a raging battle for a second day after Taliban militants attacked French troops. 10 French soldiers are dead. 13 militants are dead. Clashes that symbolize a year that could wind up the deadliest since the U.S. invasion. When the first war front on terror becomes the second, it's The Takeaway.
All across America, this is The Takeaway with John Hockenberry and Adora Udoji from WNYC and PRI.
Good morning. It's Tuesday, August 19th. I'm Catherine Lanfer in for John Hockenberry. Good morning, Adora.
And good morning to you.
Today, we look not only to Afghanistan, but to the latest from Pakistan and the Republic of Georgia. Plus, the next stop in our road trip to the political conventions, a close-up view of our patchwork nation, and why you haven't heard much protest around the Beijing Olympics. That's all coming up this hour. But first, these headlines.
In Florida, along the southwest coast, they're prepared for serious flooding as Tropical Storm Fay heads inland after hitting land a few hours ago. Schools, government offices, and businesses are closed as forecasters predict the storm could dump up to 10 inches of rain and winds are as strong as 60 miles an hour. The vice presidential rumors are buzzing around both presidential candidates. Barack Obama is expected to make his decision as early as tomorrow. The Democratic National Convention gets underway in Denver on Monday, and he'll let people know by text message and email.
In Afghanistan, 10 French soldiers have been killed and more than 20 wounded in an ongoing battle with Taliban militants outside of Kabul. That's the biggest loss for international forces in Afghanistan in more than 3 years. And in the eastern Afghan province of Khost, U.S. and Afghan forces successfully fought off a second suicide attack in as many days. A suicide car bombing targeting a police academy rocked the Algerian capital of Algiers, killing at least 43 and wounding dozens more. The attack occurred as young police applicants were waiting in line to register for school. No one has claimed responsibility yet.
Russia has agreed to add more international observers in the breakaway Georgian province of South Ossetia. This comes as NATO members are meeting in Brussels today to decide the next steps to deal with Russia. The U.S. ambassador to NATO, Kurt Volker, says the allies need to take a hard line.
In a situation where Russia is using its military forces in this way, acting on the territory of a neighboring state, there can't be business as usual in NATO's relationship with Russia.
And on the ground in Georgia, there are reports that Russian tanks are pulling out of the town of Gori and heading home. But in the port town of Poti, there's been an explosion, reportedly, and Russian soldiers are arresting Georgian troops.
Oil prices have fallen to just above $112 a barrel in Asia trading. The Dow and the S&P both lost a little more than 1.5%. The Dow stands at 11,479, and the S&P opens at 1278. Adora?
And soon we'll know who Barack Obama will choose as his vice presidential running mate. Who do you think he should pick? Who do you think John McCain should pick? Who would you like to see on those tickets? Give us a call at 877-8-MY-TAKE or drop us a note at mytake@thetakeaway.org.
The Takeaway is made possible by Liberty Mutual's Responsibility Project, encouraging discussion about what it means to do the right thing. ResponsibilityProject.com. The Takeaway is supported by the John S. and James L. Knight Foundation, advancing journalistic excellence in the digital age. More information at knightfoundation.org, the Corporation for Public Broadcasting, and by the Alfred P. Sloan Foundation to enhance public understanding of science and technology in the modern world. You're listening to The Takeaway with John Hockenberry and Adora Udoji.
Good morning, everyone. Sitting with me today is Catherine Lanfer, who's in for John Hockenberry. And we're going to begin with a NATO today and an emergency meeting that's been called to figure out how NATO is going to respond to Russia's invasion into Georgia. And NATO was set to send a strong signal of support for Georgia as the United States urged allies today to boost military ties with the former Soviet Republic on Russia's southern border. Secretary of State Condoleezza Rice has been pushing to create a permanent NATO-Georgia commission. Diplomats say she's also pushing to increase training for the Georgian military. BBC correspondent Nick Childs is following the story for us from London. He joins us now. Thanks for being with us, Nick. What options are on the table for NATO as they sit down to discuss this prickly situation?
Well, I think the problems for NATO is that their options are pretty limited. There's no question of NATO getting involved, weighing in militarily, but clearly the sense is that it can't be business as usual with Russia. Most of the NATO countries agree that this is a pretty aggressive move by the Russians, and it can't be business as usual. But there are differences over just how strong a message to send and what kind of message to send. So probably all we're going to get is rhetorical support for Georgia, maybe some extra promises of humanitarian aid as the issue of the humanitarian problem raises its head. The question is, what will be the message to Russia, though? To what extent will they say we can't continue the kind of dialogue, the kind of cooperation that we've been having up to now, but there are some countries in NATO who don't want to completely pull up the drawbridge?
Yeah, let's get to those distinctions in a second, but let's go back to, we've been hearing this over and over again, it can't be business as usual. We've been hearing that from Secretary of State Condoleezza Rice and also from the ambassador to NATO, the U.S. ambassador to NATO. But what can that possibly mean? Most of these countries are very dependent on Russia at a minimal for resources like natural gas and oil.
Yes, that's clearly one of the problems. Countries like Germany, for example, particularly, are both in terms of business and in terms of energy supplies deeply into relations with Russia. Frankly, the United States as well has a whole raft of issues and concerns, whether it's Iran, weapons proliferation, whatever it happens to be, where it kind of needs Russia to be on side. So it's a difficult one. But at the same time, the longer things continue to stagnate on the ground, the longer the Russians, at least in Western terms, appear to prevaricate over doing what they supposedly, at least as far as the French and the Americans and others are concerned, signed up to, then the more difficult it gets for NATO not to do anything or only to do things that really amount to a slap on the wrist.
Nick, let's talk about that distinction here. You have the Brits and the Americans on one side, and you have the Germans and the French on the other side. The Americans wanting to pull a harder line than, let's say, the German and French. Explain that for us.
Yes, well, I think it's always been the case that in terms of things like expanding NATO and as far as people like President Bush are concerned, solidifying the sort of democratic processes in what used to be parts of the Soviet Union, they've been leaning forward much more than, say, the Germans and the French, who have been more worried about the impact and the kind of signals it sends to Russia. And let's remember that the Russians have been complaining for some time now as what they see as NATO encroaching ever more in what they call the near abroad. So those tensions have always been the case, and it was the case at the NATO summit just a few months ago when the issues of Georgian membership of NATO and Ukrainian membership of NATO came up, and the signal was sent out that yes, that could happen at some time in the future, but people like the Germans and the French were much more reluctant in terms of offering a very concrete plan and a very concrete timetable. Whether that's going to shift now, whether we're going to get more of a signal to Georgia that the commitment is still there because of what's happened with Russia, we'll have to see.
Nick Childs, many thanks. Nick Childs, BBC correspondent, talking about NATO. Also in the news today, Catherine, as you know, Pakistan. This is day two, or I should say day one, following the resignation of President Pervez Musharraf. And Pakistani leaders have apparently been holding marathon meetings in the capital, Islamabad.
Big questions about what's going to happen next.
About what's going to happen next, particularly to fill that role, but also for this fragile coalition government to figure out how it will continue to govern in the midst of facing very serious problems. We're going to go straight to the New York Times' Jane Perlez reporting from Islamabad. Jane, many thanks for being with us.
Good morning. How are you?
I'm good. So it's the day after. What's the feeling there in Islamabad?
Well, the politicians didn't waste any time to getting down to what really divides them rather than unites them. For 10 days there, getting rid of Musharraf rather united them. Now today they're ensconced in a meeting to decide how and when they might restore judges who were fired by Musharraf and who are a very contentious issue here.
Now, in this coalition government, you have two strong parties led by two strong individuals. Could you break that down for us and tell us how they're getting along these days? Because they have, in the past, been sworn enemies.
One party is the Pakistan People's Party. It's got the most seats in the parliament, and it was led by Benazir Bhutto. Before her father, who was who led Pakistan for many years. So it is a traditional, rather working people's party. It is now led by Benazir's widower, Asif Ali Zardari, who has little experience in government, although he did have a post in her government when she was prime minister twice in the 1990s. The other party is the Pakistan Muslim League, and it's led by Nawaz Sharif, who was prime minister twice in the 1990s. So they are the two rival parties from the 1990s, and they're trying very hard to get along. But evidence today makes it look as though it is still very hard.
Because now they've got to fill this post of president that is largely ceremonial but had been looked at quite differently, as Pervez Musharraf filled that seat after having been prime minister for nearly a decade. It's really not about filling the post in terms of the substance of the person filling the post, but about who will have control over filling the post, isn't it?
Well, just to be clear, Musharraf was president for nearly 9 years, and as president he had, and when he was president he was chief of the army, so he had extraordinary power, and for much of his time was basically a dictator. The post of the president is what's in contention now, of course, and the question is, yes, which party will control it, and it's pretty much decided that the Pakistan People's Party, the party with the most votes, will choose to nominate a candidate, and that candidate will presumably be chosen by the Electoral College of the Parliament and four assemblies. But the new president will most likely be rather symbolic rather than a strong man like Musharraf.
Jane, this is Catherine Lamfer. What sense do we have of what kind of opposition either party in leadership would present to the Taliban?
Well, it's hard to tell, and of course this is a big question for Washington and a very frustrating question for Washington. The Prime Minister, who we haven't mentioned yet, is a figure from the Pakistan People's Party, and he visited Washington at the end of July and had lunch with George Bush and met the Defense Department, etc. And I think that, and he had a public session at the Council on Foreign Relations. And I think people in both the Bush administration and outside the Bush administration who are concerned with issues in South Asia were very disturbed because the Prime Minister, Mr. Gilani, had very few ideas of how to tackle the Taliban beyond saying, well, let's work together. But I gather his presentations and his ideas were very, very thin. And frankly, Zardari and Nawaz are really not interested in the tribal areas. They say they are, but they're not really. So it's an unanswered question, but a very important one.
Jane Perlez, thank you so much.
Pleasure.
Jane Perlez reports for The New York Times, and she was coming to us from Islamabad.
You can email us at mytake@thetakeaway.org or call us toll-free at 877-8-MYTAKE.
869-8253.
Today's conversation on The Takeaway is supported by Liberty Mutual's Responsibility Project, a forum for examining the decisions that confront people trying to do the right thing. Discussions and more at responsibilityproject.com.
You're listening to The Takeaway with John Hockenberry and Adora Udoji from WNYC and PRI, Public Radio International, in collaboration with the BBC World Service, The New York Times, and WGBH Radio Boston.
Good morning. It's Tuesday, August 19th. I'm Catherine Lanfer, in for John Hockenberry. Now, all week, we are riding along with The Takeaway's political director, Andrea Bernstein, and our web producer, Adam Hirsch, as they make their way to the conventions. All right, Andrea, where are you today?
We're in Monroe County, Ohio, which is in eastern Ohio. It's a very, very rural area, lots of green hills, rolling countryside, barns, cows,
Andrea,
lots of truck drivers, farmers.
Yeah, you're working your way toward the word bucolic, I can tell.
Yeah, I am working my way towards the word bucolic, and no cell phone access.
Okay, all right. Now, we heard from voters yesterday with your travels, but we also heard from listeners. What'd you hear from people responding to your reports yesterday?
Well, yesterday, after our first day in eastern Pennsylvania, we heard a comment on our website from a listener, P.J. Rodriguez, and he said to us, "I was startled to hear the vagueness in people's answers. Well, I guess I'll vote for Obama. I don't have a choice. The lesser of two evils. There are clear and distinct differences between the two candidates. There was a long and hard-fought primary. What on earth are these people looking for? I'd love to hear them ask to express some clarity on this." So thanks, P.J., for that comment, and we did just that. We went and we asked people, do you think there are differences between the candidates? And we got a couple of comments here. The first was at the Monroe County Fair, where we were yesterday evening around sunset. I was chatting with some people outside the animal barns as the dust was swirling up. You'll hear some animals braying. We were also in Pittsburgh earlier, which is a very urban center. It did vote for Obama, but it's an area with a lot of conservative Democrats. So the first comment we're going to hear is from a former aluminum factory worker named Jerry Roth.
Do you think that there's a difference between Barack Obama and John McCain on the issues?
Oh, yeah, there's a difference between the two on issues.
So that doesn't make you want to go out and vote for Obama, even though you voted Democrat in the primary?
No, absolutely not.
You're not doing it?
No.
A little less sure was a woman that I spoke to in a Starbucks in downtown Pittsburgh. This is a really revitalized urban area. And she herself worked in the television industry. Her name was Carrie Maniot, who had been a Hillary Clinton voter. Here's what she had to say about the differences between the candidates.
I tend to vote Democratic, but I don't always vote Democratic, so I'm kind of open to any alternate candidates that might be available and kind of spark my interest. And I don't see McCain as your typical Republican. He's more of a Democratic Republican, if that's such a thing. So.
Wow, Andrea. What alternative candidate is she thinking of?
Well, I think that she was thinking about an alternative to Democrat. She usually votes Democrat. She voted for Hillary Clinton. But, you know, she gave the reason that a lot of people gave to me, which is that, you know, which is something that I heard in the primary, too. What's extraordinary is that here we are. We're a week from the Democratic convention, and these feelings are so raw, so close to the surface, and there are at least a faction of Hillary Clinton voters that have not gotten over it. Now, I don't want to maintain that is everybody. I spoke to a woman named Clara Crowell, who worked in the Performing Arts Center in Pittsburgh, and she had also been a Hillary Clinton voter, but she was ready to make the switch. Here she is.
You usually vote Democrat, Republican?
Democrat? I'm a registered Democrat.
Did you vote here in the primary?
I did.
Voted for Obama?
No, I voted for Hillary.
So how are you feeling about Obama?
I don't know. I'm trusting him, so...
Andrea, that was a really long pause.
It was a long pause. And I have spoken to the Obama campaign about this ambivalence I'm hearing from voters. And what they say is it's still very early. It's the summertime. People's attention are focused elsewhere. They're yet to be the conventions. They are yet to run their ad campaigns. A week from the Democratic convention, when Hillary Clinton is going to stand up there and say, go and vote for Obama, some of her supporters are still reluctant to do so or say they will not. Here are a couple of folks that I spoke to outside the barn over at the Monroe County Fair last night. First gentleman didn't want to give his name, but here he is talking about his vote in November.
Well, I'm debating on running because we ain't got anybody else doing it, so that's my opinion. Uh-huh.
You usually vote Republican, Democrat?
Democrat.
Huh? So, and you don't like Barack Obama?
I don't care for him, and I don't care for McCain either, so I probably will not vote this year.
Did you vote for Hillary Clinton?
I did.
And she said, if you supported me, you should support my agenda by supporting Barack Obama.
I don't believe that.
I did. I heard a lot of that. I heard a lot of, I don't believe it. I'm not going to do what she said. Now, you know, I should say that there's ambivalence about McCain. I mean, I did run into Republicans, and they were saying, well, I'll probably vote for McCain, or I'm not sure if I'm going to vote for McCain. I'm looking at Obama because McCain is too old. I heard quite a bit of that. But the top of the mind emotion in Monroe County, which did vote for Hillary Clinton in the primary, and is a sort of lower economic class, a lot of steel workers, former aluminum workers that live in this area, and it's a pretty Democratic county. They do not, in case you're wondering, like Bush, but they're not blaming McCain for it. Here's a couple named the Roberts, and this is what they said.
I can't do that because Obama don't have enough experience. He's been a senator, what, 4 years? No, I can't do that.
You're a Hillary Clinton supporter, too?
Yes, but not Obama.
Can either of you see yourself voting for McCain?
This is last resort.
What do you think of the job that President Bush has done?
Crap.
Are you sure you weren't at that barnyard you were talking about earlier?
That was one of the more polite expressions. I mean, I have to say that Republicans, Democrats, feelings were pretty universal that people were unhappy with the way that Bush has handled the country. And what varied was the extent to which people were going to hang that on McCain. Quite a few people, including some Democrats, said that they were not necessarily going to hang that on McCain.
Okay, quickly, Andrea, where are you headed tomorrow?
Well, we're going to try to find some activists amid all this ambivalence. We're in the state of Ohio, very important swing state. Lots of organizing always takes place here, so we're going to look for the activists here and find out what they're doing to get people excited and get them to the polls in November.
All right. Andrea Bernstein, thank you so much. Always a pleasure to talk to Andrea. She is the Takeaway's political director, and if you want to ride along on their trip, their road trip to the convention, go to thetakeaway.org right now for some headlines. We are going to Femi Okeh.
Hi there. Just coming up to 29 and a half minutes past the hour for a quick look at stories making the news this morning. Tropical Storm Fay is now on land in southwest Florida. Russia is agreeing to more than the triple of number of international monitors in South Ossetia province. And in Afghanistan, 14 French parachutists are dead in a two-day firefight after they were ambushed by Taliban militants outside the capital, Kabul. That's the single biggest loss of life for international forces in more than 3 years.
Thanks, fam.
The Takeaway is supported by the Bill and Melinda Gates Foundation, dedicated to the idea that all people deserve the chance to live a healthy, productive life. Information at gatesfoundation.org. And by the Henry Luce Foundation for increased understanding of East and Southeast Asia.
The Takeaway is made possible by Liberty Mutual's Responsibility Project, featuring stories of responsible acts that happen every day. Stories to read, share, and respond to available at responsibilityproject.com. Because one responsible act can make an unforgettable difference.
You're listening to The Takeaway with John Hockenberry and Adora Udoji.
Good morning on this Tuesday, August 19th. Catherine Lanfer is with me today, sitting in for John Hockenberry.
And I'm happy to be here.
And today, in Afghanistan, insurgents ambushed a group of French parachutists outside Kabul, starting a battle that killed 10 French soldiers. It's the biggest loss of life for international forces in combat in Afghanistan in more than 3 years. This comes as Afghanistan celebrates its independence this week. Officials estimate that at this rate, violence could lead to the deadliest year since the U.S.-led invasion. That's led to talk of sending more U.S. troops and perhaps reassigning some from Iraq. John Dempsey is a law advisor in Kabul for the congressionally funded U.S. Peace Institute. He's lived there nearly 6 years. John, welcome. You say things are worse today than when you got there. What do you mean?
Things are much worse today than when I arrived here back in January 2003. At that time, the Taliban had just recently been kicked out of power, and there was a sense of optimism and hope among Afghans that reconstruction and development in the country was going to proceed and that people's lives were going to improve relatively soon. And close to 6 years on now, that clearly hasn't happened, and things have deteriorated significantly, and there's a growing sense of pessimism among ordinary Afghans as to exactly what the international effort here has achieved.
Let's talk about the violence. We hear increasingly more and more reports like those of this morning. Is this something that you, being in Kabul, are fundamentally aware of?
Yeah, this year alone has been by far the worst since I've been here, but it's gotten progressively worse each year. There have been a number of attacks against Western troops. The number of Western troops killed here this year is at its highest rate since the war began. Aid workers have been increasingly under attack. Just last week, there were 3 International Rescue Committee workers killed fairly close to Kabul. And so reports are that, you know, the Taliban is creeping closer and closer to the capital. And in fact, there have been a number of suicide attacks inside Kabul, this year. The largest one being at the Indian Embassy in early July, when over 40 people were killed.
So in your mind, based on your experience there, it's all evidence of a resurgent Taliban. What do you attribute this reemergence and this seeming strength and boldness in the kinds of attacks against NATO-led troops?
Well, I mean, I think it's a few things. One, the Taliban themselves have had time to regroup since they were kicked out of Afghanistan in 2001. And they went across the border into Pakistan, where they have safe haven and sanctuary, and were able to regroup and re-strategize. They've also learned from tactics that were used in Iraq, and they're receiving funding from certain countries in the Middle East to continue their attacks. But also, as I mentioned before, I mean, the sense of optimism has essentially dissipated, and people have no confidence whatsoever in the ability of the Karzai government to provide even basic government services. And so I think people are starting to look towards the Taliban days, when there was stability and security in the country, is actually not so bad. And the Taliban themselves are starting to feel that they have more support, and as such, they're becoming more bold in their tactics.
John, this is Catherine Lanfer. Given the picture that you've described of increasing violence, why are you still there?
Well, I don't think that it's a failed state yet. I do think there are opportunities, and that we do have an obligation to try to do what we can to help the Karzai government, or to help the Afghan central government begin to build some credibility and legitimacy in the country. I think stabilizing and securing Afghanistan is important for America's interests. It's important for regional interests, and in fact, you know, for world interests. This is obviously a part of the world that's in the headlines on a daily basis. And when I talk about this part of the world, I'm referring to the neighbors as well. Particularly Pakistan, where just yesterday Musharraf resigned, and clearly that country's been experiencing substantial turmoil itself over the last few months. So I do think it's important to try to help the government here build some legitimacy and be able to reach out and have an ability to be viewed as a legitimate authority that has the right to use force in the country and to extend its remit into the provinces.
Finally, quickly, John, when you talk about this lack of faith that Afghans have in the government, what do you attribute that to?
Well, I mean, that partly, I think, they're traditionally in Afghanistan, people have not looked to the central government as the sole authority to provide governance. I mean, people generally have lived their lives and been governed on a communal basis through traditions and customs here. And so when the Western effort to help the Karzai government reestablish itself started, people looked at this as foreign concepts being imposed in the country, and there was a lot of distrust as to what was actually happening and what these efforts were actually going to achieve. Now, if they were able to tackle some of the things that
right.
had prevented the central government from gaining its legitimacy, like corruption, I think that they'd be able to have be viewed in a bit more positive light.
John Dempsey, many thanks. John Dempsey, rule of law advisor from the U.S. Peace Institute. Now we're going to turn to Femi Okeh, who's got a few headlines for us. Femi?
Thank you very much, Adora. Starting with some news from the economy, the government says that the construction of homes and apartments fell in July to the lowest level in more than 17 years. And wholesale inflation has surged by 1.2% in July. That's more than double than what was expected. In Belgium today, the Secretary of State Condoleezza Rice and her NATO counterparts are holding emergency meetings on the Russia-Georgia conflict. Russia's Deputy Ambassador to NATO, Ivan Soltanovsky, has a message for the foreign ministers gathered in Brussels.
Cool down, take an objective assessment of the situation, and think twice before taking any decisions concerning our partnership within the framework of NATO-Russia Council.
Officials at the NATO talks in Brussels have announced in the last few hours that Russia has agreed to increased international monitoring in South Ossetia. The latest from the ground in that conflict, an officer says that a column of Russian tanks is leaving the Georgian city of Gori. Earlier today, the two sides exchanged prisoners. Meanwhile, there are reports that Russian forces have blockaded a port in the coastal city of Poti and are arresting Georgian soldiers there. Near the Afghan capital Kabul, 10 French soldiers serving with NATO have been killed and 20 more have been wounded in fighting with Taliban militants. Security officials say the battle has been going on since yesterday. It's the deadliest day for international forces in Afghanistan in 3 years. And a French official says that Zambia's President Levi Mwanawasa has died. He was 59. The statement from President Nicolas Sarkozy's office did not say how or when or where the Zambian leader had died. He had been hospitalised in France since he suffered a stroke in June. And what was a very unfortunate occurrence at the time was that his death was reported before he actually had died, and then all of the death reports had to be retracted. But I can confirm President Mwanawasa of Zambia has died.
Thank you, Femi.
The Takeaway is made possible by Liberty Mutual's Responsibility Project, encouraging discussion about what it means to do the right thing. ResponsibilityProject.com.
Good morning, I'm Adora Udoji, and this is The Takeaway.
I'm Catherine Lanford. I'm in for John Hockenberry. Now, Adora, you remember that when the Olympic torch was wending its way through the world, it was mobbed by protests, right?
Oh, right, yes.
Now, have you noticed something about this Olympics?
No protests.
Well, the country, China, will allow protests, but that's only pending approval and only in 3 designated spots. Yes, there are protest zones. We're going to turn now to Beijing and the New York Times' Andrew Jacobs. He's going to set the scene for us. Now, Andrew, you've looked into this. How much protest is going on in the designated zones?
As far as we can tell, absolutely none.
Where are the zones located?
They're pretty far away from the Olympic Green. They're in three city parks that are kind of spread around the city. And so far, everything going on there is just park-related activity, people lounging and having a good, having a nice time.
Now, we have heard stories, people have applied for the protests, the permits to protest, but what happens when they do?
Well, according to the government, 77 people have applied, and 74 of those people have since withdrawn their applications after the government, as they put it, successfully mediated their issues, their conflicts, and the remaining 2 others were rejected for not having enough information, and one other was rejected for violating Chinese law on protests.
Mediated their issues?
Well, as they put it, they were referred to relevant authorities who dealt with the problem.
When you say dealt, is that code for arrested?
Well, probably in not all the cases. There have been six cases that we know of people who went to apply and were detained either during or immediately after the application process. So I'm not sure about the rest of them, though.
I know that in particular you spoke to one young man who slipped into Beijing last week hoping to be a one-man rally. What happened to him?
He went to the Public Security Bureau to apply. He was told to come back in 5 days for his answer, and then that evening he was detained and sent back to his hometown where he's now in custody.
Okay, Andrew, I have to ask this. Why would anyone go back?
Why would they? Well, they don't go back by choice. They're actually escorted back by police officials from their town who are sent
No, but I mean, when the officials say to you, come back in 5 days, why would you come back?
I guess people have a little sliver of hope that they might actually get what they're looking for. I mean, the government did announce, and it was on Chinese television news, that they were going to establish these zones, and people, this gentleman, for example, heard that, and he came. He was lured here, you could say, by the promise of you know, the potential to protest.
Quickly, signs of protest anywhere else around the Olympics?
Well, there have just been a few kind of guerrilla protests by foreign groups like Students for Free Tibet and some Christian activists, but otherwise that's it.
All right. Andrew Jacobs, thanks so much for joining us.
Thank you.
It's Andrew Jacobs. Bye. He's a New York Times reporter reporting on the dearth of protests in Beijing at the Olympics. I don't know.
It just sounds absurd.
I'm Catherine Lampert.
Today's conversation on The Takeaway is supported by Liberty Mutual, dedicated to celebrating personal responsibility and to proving its own with a comprehensive array of home, auto, and life insurance products. More information at libertymutual.com or 1-800-4-LIBERTY. Responsibility, what's your policy?
You're listening to The Takeaway with John Hockenberry and Adora Udoji from Public Radio International and WNYC in collaboration with the BBC World Service, The New York Times, and WGBH Radio Boston.
Good morning. I'm Catherine Lanfer, sitting in for John Hockenberry. Now, we are keeping an eye on the vice presidential picks by candidates Barack Obama and John McCain, but we also want to hear from you. Who do you think they should choose?
Oh, hi. My name is Jean from New Jersey. I think that Mr. Obama should probably choose someone like Richardson to get the Latin American vote, and Mr. McCain should choose, well, actually, I think an African American woman would be great for him to choose.
Wow, that's interesting responses. Thank you so much for that. We do appreciate it. Tell
We've
us what you think.
We've got some savvy people
yeah,
out
I
there.
Yeah, I mean, well, there's certainly reasons to argue why that one might work for them individually. Give us a call at 877-8-MY-TAKE. Give us your thought. And we're going to try to gauge, or at least we're going to talk to some folks now who are gauging exactly what Americans are thinking. And that story is going to come up briefly as we get some headlines from Femi Oke first. Femi?
Oprah Winfrey and Barack Obama? How does that work?
Femi!
That would be earth-shattering.
I think it's a
good way to describe how that would work.
What would happen to the book club? I think the book club would be off the charts. Good morning, everybody. Mm. Coming up to 11 minutes to the hour. The Commerce Department has just released some numbers this morning. It says that last month, home construction fell to the lowest level in more than 17 years. And wholesale inflation surged by 1.2% last month, more than double what had been expected. As NATO ministers are meeting in Brussels today, Russia has agreed to increased international monitoring in southern Ossetia. The Kremlin has announced that Russian troops were leaving the city of Gori, but the latest reports say that Russian soldiers are now taking Georgian troops prisoner in the port town of Poti. In Afghanistan, 10 French soldiers are dead and more than 20 have been wounded outside of the capital. Pro-Taliban insurgents began a fierce assault on French troops yesterday. Officials say it's the biggest loss for an international force in 3 years. Texas Governor Rick Perry says he's fine with school teachers packing heat. A school district near the Oklahoma border has decided to let school staff carry guns as long as they're licensed and use ammunition with a low risk of ricochet. And finally, a long-running university program looking for alternative exercise options have found that rock drummers are pretty good athletes. Have a listen to Clem Burke here, working up a sweat on Blondie's Heart of Glass. Can you picture him? He's there on his snare drum, doing all that working out. Now, Clem has been helping doctors in the United Kingdom. They monitored him, and after 90 minutes of vigorous rock drumming, he burned 60 calories. So if you put rock drummers on tour every day, they're actually burning a lot of calories for all of the tours, the concerts they're playing, almost as much as soccer players, because they only play one or two big games in a week or every 2 weeks. The UK universities are looking for attractive exercise options for overweight children. So they might not want to go out and jog, but they might want to drum for an hour or so, burning up some calories.
Oh, that's interesting. Huh, thanks, Femi.
Oh, you're welcome.
And now we're going to get on to those folks who are trying to gauge what Americans are feeling and who they see themselves as. In the 19th century, poet Walt Whitman had an idea that many have been seeking to try to define over the decades. And Waltman said, and I'm paraphrasing here, the genius of the United States is not best or most in its executives or legislators, but always most in the common people. The Christian Science Monitor has taken up the challenge of finding out what regular people believe and feel in a quest they're calling the Patchwork Nation. They've broken the country up into 11 different sociocultural political districts with names like Boomtown or Tractor Country or Military Bastion, and are writing and blogging about them. Dante Cheney is a national correspondent for the Christian Science Monitor and the leader of the Patrick Project. He joins us. Thanks so much for being with us, Dante. And let's start with Hopkinsville, Kentucky. You just wrote about that community. How would you categorize it, and what did you learn about it?
Well, Hopkinsville is something we call a military bastion, and there are these counties around the country, and this is all done by county, which was the best way, it turns out, to sort the data, because there was what was available, and building it up another way, starting at community level, and it would have been just nightmarish in terms of work. But military bastions are these places that they sit near military bases, or they've got a high number of veterans or National Guardsmen in it, and it does create kind of a unique atmosphere. And what these things are that we found is that they're places. It's not about types of voters so much as types of place in America, and the idea is where you live and the issues you deal with every day, the people you see and you talk to on the street, all these things end up shaping how you view the world.
And how do the folks in Hopkinsville view the world?
Well, they are a little different. They tend to view the world. Iraq is a big issue there, but it's not the issue that it is for, like, say, you and I. It's a much more personal issue. They know a lot of people serving over there, and they don't talk about the war. Nobody really talks about the war in Hopkinsville. You're not supposed to talk about the war in Hopkinsville.
It has one of the highest casualty counts, doesn't it, in Iraq? They have a very high number. Yes.
They have a huge number of people over there, yeah, and some are on their third and fourth tours even now. You know, and the other thing that's done there is it's actually hit the economy, because that's people there that are not spending money, you know, at the, long line of Applebee's and Chili's and the things that kind of occupy the thing they call the Strip in Hopkinsville.
And you talked a little bit about the process you used to define the 11 regions. You said you went through county information. What kind of information? How did you build this model so that you could come up with these definitions?
Well, we started out thinking that there had to be a better way of understanding the country and sorting through all this data, and said, well, what about census data? And it all exists by county anyway. So that was what we used. And we used a variety of things. We didn't want it to be one just age or just occupation. So these 11 groups are kind of cross-sections of all sorts of data, including age, occupation, religion, income, and some kind of elementary consumer data, alcohol sales, tobacco sales, percentage of new cars, and things like that.
Well, how interesting. And you also have some people who are helping you out, and those would be the bloggers like Kathy Hiker. Your area is described as a boom town. What does that mean exactly?
Eagle is a small town in the mountains west of Vail. We're 30 miles west of the ski resort of Vail. In the past about 8 years, the population has nearly doubled. So the town is going through rapid change. In a recent survey, more than 55% of the residents of the town had lived here 5 years or less. So we're seeing a lot of new people who are bringing a lot of new values and opinions to the community.
And a lot of new ones. So what is the old Eagle, Colorado, and what's the new one today in terms of views of who they are and their view on the world?
The old Eagle was more of a originally a ranching community. People had ranching sort of values, simple values. What we've got here now is people moving in to a sort of swanky new subdivision, and they're moving down from the Vail area. They're looking for more urban services and amenities than the previous population was.
So they like the creature comfort, and you're not far from Vail, and we know people like their creature comfort there in Vail. But let me go back to you, Dante, which is what you found is that there are a lot of similarities, although there are real differences. I mean, we just heard about two, Hopkinsville and also there in Eagle, Colorado, very different, but there are some things that people in both places are worried about today, and what is that?
Well, the economy, it's really interesting the way the economy has kind of seeped into everything. And it's you view it through gas prices, and some places it comes up in terms of foreclosures. I do have some communities that are seeing, obscene foreclosure rates. And, you know, all these things together have kind of made the economy, without question, the main issue out there right now shaping the election. And it's going to be bigger. And the other thing that's really going on out there that we don't quite get in the media is people have kind of been disengaged for the last couple months. People really have not been paying, as much as we all like to pay attention to every hiccup in the race. They've tuned out for a bit, and they're ready to tune back in now, I think, but they've been gone for a while.
Ready to tune back in. I think there's a takeaway in there somewhere. That's Dante Cheney. Thank you. Dante is a correspondent for the Christian Science Monitor, and he's leading the Patchwork Nation Project. Also, thank you, Kathy Hiker. Kathy is a blogger from Patchwork Nation, also blogging from Eagle, Colorado.
Of course, speaking of a takeaway, let's go ahead and listen to today's.
I don't know what I'm doing this year. This is my first uncertain year.
That was Sherry Suppa. She's a school teacher in Pittsburgh, Pennsylvania, talking with our political director, Andrea Bernstein, who's on the campaign trail in Pennsylvania this week. Remember, we want to know who you would pick as vice president and what your take is on the political race. That go to mytake@thetakeaway.org.
Today, we're also following the story about the 10 French soldiers killed in new clashes in Afghanistan, as well as a U.S. soldier killed on the eastern border there. Also, how NATO might try to resolve the conflict between Russia and Georgia. So if you missed any part of our show, you know you can always sign on to www.thetakeaway.org. I'm Adora Udoji.
The Takeaway is supported by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting, the John S. and James L. Knight Foundation, advancing journalistic excellence in the digital age. More information at knightfoundation.org. And by the Rockefeller Foundation and its Campaign for American Workers. More at rockfound.org. This is The Takeaway.
Hello and welcome to the vice presidential dating game. Playing today, he's a charismatic candidate under a deadline to pick who will accompany him to a fabulous, fun-filled week in Denver. Barack Obama, you could choose from a safe Midwestern senator, a swing state governor, or bachelor number three. Who will it be? It's The Takeaway.
All across America, this is The Takeaway with John Hockenberry and Adora Udoji from WNYC and PRI.
Good morning. It's Tuesday, August 19th. I'm Adora Udoji, and Catherine Lanfer is in for John Hockenberry. Good morning, Catherine.
Good morning, Adora.
Today, America awaits news of Senator Barack Obama's VP choice. Could come any time now. The Democratic convention is only 6 days away. Also, NATO holds an emergency meeting in Brussels to decide what to do about Russia. And one small Cape Cod town feels the grief of the Iraq and Afghanistan wars. Two of their own were killed last weekend. That's all coming up this hour. But first, these headlines. Residents along Florida's southwest coast are prepared for serious flooding as Tropical Storm Fay heads inland after hitting land a few hours ago. Schools, government offices, and businesses are closed as forecasters predict the storm could dump up to 8 inches of rain. Winds are as strong as 60 miles an hour.
In Afghanistan, 10 French soldiers were killed and more than 20 wounded in a gun battle with Taliban militants outside of Kabul today. That's the biggest loss for international forces in Afghanistan in more than 3 years. And in the eastern Afghan province of Khost, U.S. and Afghan forces successfully fending off a second suicide attack in as many days. In Algeria, a suicide car bombing targeted a police academy in the capital of Algiers today, killing more than 40 young police recruits and wounding dozens more. No one has claimed responsibility yet.
Russian troops are on the move again in Georgia today. This time, reporters say Russian tanks are on their way out of the city of Gori. Georgian students nearby are protesting Russia's presence.
We are from different universities. We are the people, we are the students who are gathered here for defend our world, for defend our country. We strongly believe that this reaction, this action will be very important for our country and for the rest of the world.
There are, though, conflicting reports about how robust the Russian troop withdrawal actually is. In the key port city of Pauti, Russian troops appear to be digging in. Also, at the request of NATO officials meeting in Brussels today, Russia has agreed to more than triple the number of international observers in the breakaway province of South Ossetia.
Wholesale inflation surged to 1.2% last month, more than double what had been expected. That means prices for the past year rose at their fastest pace in 27 years.
And the vice presidential rumors are buzzing around both presidential candidates. We'll have more on that story coming up.
Oil prices have fallen to just about $112 a barrel in Asia trading. The Dow and the S&P, let's see, the Dow stands at 11,479 and the S&P opens at 1278, Adora.
And we're asking you, who should Barack Obama pick? Who do you think would do well on that Democratic ticket? Or alternatively, who do you think would do well on the John McCain ticket? You can give us a call at 877-8-MY-TAKE or drop us a note at mytake@thetakeaway.org. Who should the respective Republican and Democratic presumptive nominees pick? Let us know.
The Takeaway is made possible by Liberty Mutual's Responsibility Project, encouraging discussion about what it means to do the right thing. ResponsibilityProject.com. The Takeaway is supported by the John S. and James L. Knight Foundation, advancing journalistic excellence in the digital age. More information at knightfoundation.org, the Corporation for Public Broadcasting, and by the Alfred P. Sloan Foundation to enhance public understanding of science and technology in the modern world. You're listening to The Takeaway with John Hockenberry and Adora Udoji.
I'm Catherine Lanfer, in for John Hockenberry. Oil production is down. Now, part of the reason for that is political, and we can look at the conflict between Russia and Georgia. OPEC, however, is also considering a cut to oil production to keep prices from falling below $100 per barrel. You might remember that oil prices hit a high this year, the week of July 4th, reaching just over $140. Now, of course, prices are currently hovering somewhere around $110. And that dropped in part because of the fading threat of Tropical Storm Fay. Well, to help us figure this all out, we're going to go now to Jad Moad. He is a staff reporter at the New York Times who covers the energy industry. All right, Jad, who exactly is having problems? Western companies? OPEC? Who is it?
Well, yeah, this is really a problem for the Western companies. You know, the sort of, you know, what we call sort of the you know, big oil, the former, you know, Seven Sisters. Companies like ExxonMobil, Chevron, Conoco, and a bunch of European companies, Shell and BP. And, you know, their problem has been that, you know, as oil prices have gone up, obviously their profits have soared, but a really disturbing trend has emerged that in the past few quarters, their actual production has been declining. And then the last quarter, the second quarter where they announced their results, that drop for the top five companies was over 600,000 barrels a day, which is not insignificant. I mean, it's about 5% of their overall production.
Now, I'm a little confused, if only because if they are flush with cash, doesn't that give them some wiggle room to figure out new ways or new places?
Right. You would think. I mean, there are two things happening here, and obviously the high prices are, leading to the sort of the best times that this industry has ever had. At the same time, these high prices are also, in a way, kind of constraining their ability to produce for many reasons. Remember, these guys mostly operate in countries where the resource owner are governments. I mean, there are very few countries in the world outside of the U.S. where, the owner is not the government. And so these governments, when prices go up, typically will ask for a bigger take. And the way that happens, in some countries, they will ask for more oil. Therefore, mechanically, the Western companies will have fewer barrels. But also, they will ask for, tougher deals. And we've seen this in pretty much every country where companies operate. They will increase the taxes. They will increase the government take. They will ask for their national oil companies to have a bigger share of the profits. And so you're finding yourself in a world where the companies that sort of are the best at, investing and increasing production, the Western companies, are finding themselves kind of running out of places to drill.
Jad, all of this gets very confusing, particularly given the unprecedented volatility in the last couple of months. Mm-hmm. If oil production is down, why do we continue to see the price down? Because obviously this would be something of great concern to not only traders, but to companies mm-hmm. and to consumers.
Mm-hmm. Well, I mean, overall, oil production is still kind of inching up slowly. So if a barrel is not produced by, say, an Exxon, it is still produced worldwide by, the national company of, Venezuela or Saudi Arabia or a big Russian company. So overall, the global production is up, if just slightly. One of the issues we've been seeing in this market is that, these companies, for some of the reasons we just mentioned, are having trouble reinvesting their profits and growing oil production kind of as fast as demand is growing. And that's really been kind of the main driver over the past, 6 to 8 years of this big rally in oil prices. Demand, even this year, has been kind of growing faster than oil production has.
Can I just interrupt you there for a second? Mm-hmm. Is the production then a question of how much exists? Because there are certainly those out there making the argument that perhaps the peak has been reached in terms of how much exists, say, in Saudi Arabia, which
right.
would, of course, affect the global market, the global resource availability. Or
right.
is it oil production is down because the infrastructure doesn't exist to produce to the level that we are now needing for oil to be produced?
Well, from all the people that I've spoken to, it's the latter, not the former. This view out there that says that we've oil production has peaked, meaning we've produced more than half of all the oil that is out there, and therefore oil production is going to start to fall from now on. That's a tough one to endorse because there's still a lot of oil that is out there that we haven't discovered yet. I mean, the whole debate over drilling offshore or expanding offshore drilling in the U.S. is really about, where else can you go?
Jad Mawad, thank you so much. He covers the energy industry for our partner, the New York Times. Now, it might not come out explicitly in the talks in Brussels today, Adora, but you know that oil is going to be somewhere there in the conversation.
Oh, certainly, but you're right. There is an emergency meeting being held in Brussels today, and the NATO allies are gathering together. And while they all agree, seemingly, that Russia's invasion into Georgia, the Republic of Georgia, must be squarely confronted, some of the major European powers, though, are a little cool to the idea that the U.S. is pushing, which is that perhaps the allies should consider scaling back ties with Moscow. In an interview with the BBC's Jonathan Marcus, British Foreign Secretary David Miliband had this to say.
I think we should ensure that we engage with Russia in a hard-headed way. Russia is a member of the G8, but that doesn't prevent the G7 from acting as a G7. But I don't believe that a policy of isolating Russia is going to work. We need to make sure that we engage in a clear way that makes absolutely plain to Russia the consequences of its actions, the consequences of its misadventures.
For a closer look, we're joined now by BBC correspondent Nick Childs, who's following the story for us from London. Hey there, Nick.
Hello there.
So what did they accomplish in the NATO emergency meeting today?
Well, they came out with a declaration which was fairly strong in certain areas, but pretty short on concrete action, I think. And I think that will, although Condoleezza Rice, the US Secretary of State, denied it, will disappoint the Americans to some extent. There are areas they all could agree on. They're clearly getting more impatient about the fact that the Russians don't seem to be moving out of Georgia on the ground. So the NATO Secretary General said, the Russians need to honour their part of the peace agreement, and there's no sign that they're doing that at the moment. They talked about seriously considering the implications of NATO-Russian relations, but there wasn't anything specific in terms of programs being abandoned or anything. There won't be any high-level NATO-Russian meetings, it looks like, for some time, but they're not being abandoned. So I think maybe the Americans would have liked it to go a bit further. What they have said, though, is that they will step up their consultations with Georgia. So I think the message, really, the question is whether it's a strong enough message as far as Washington's concerned. The message really from NATO is, if the Russians think that they're going to be able to suck the Georgians back into their sphere of influence, actually what they're doing on the ground at the moment is achieving the opposite effect.
So was there any talk about other countries in the region? Because there's been concern about them as well, the Ukraine, Estonia.
Yes, that's right. That was the other element of what NATO will actually do now. They're going to set up a joint commission with Georgia to look at how they can increase their cooperation, and they're going to have an early meeting of a similar commission that's already been set up between NATO and Ukraine next week. So that's about as far as they've gone in terms of concrete action. As I say, if you like, to send a message to Russia that if you think that what you're doing is rebalancing the sphere of influence, actually what we think you're doing is having the opposite effect. Whether Russia cares at this stage at the moment, given that it holds so many cards actually on the ground, is another matter.
Nick, we don't have that much time left. I'm going to ask you a question that we could really talk about for an hour, but let's go behind the smoke screen. None of this is surprising, and Russia certainly wasn't expecting anything more than just words. And it's very clear that the United States has already been backing the Republic of Georgia for some time. So the idea that there would be increased contact, that's not surprising either. What really is the message to Russia here?
I think it's very much that it's on notice, if you like. I don't think NATO really knows what the full-scale implications or the long-term implications necessarily are, and they're hoping Russia will take note of what they're saying now. But Russia may just as equally take note of the fact that there clearly are some stresses and strains within NATO about how far to go in terms of sending a message, how far to go in terms of reducing ties, even perhaps potentially cutting them off, because there are interests at stake for both sides.
Nick Childs, many thanks. Nick Childs reports for the BBC, and he was coming to us from London.
You can email us at mytake@thetakeaway.org or call us toll-free at 877-8-MY-TAKE.
869-8253.
Today's conversation on The Takeaway is supported by Liberty Mutual's Responsibility Project, a forum for examining the decisions that confront people trying to do the right thing. Discussions and more at responsibilityproject.com.
You're listening to The Takeaway with John Hockenberry and Adora Udoji from WNYC and PRI, Public Radio International, in collaboration with the BBC World Service, The New York Times, and WGBH Radio Boston.
Good morning, everyone. It's Tuesday. It's August 19th, and I got a Catherine Lanfer who's sitting next to me dancing. I'm worried about you, Catherine.
It's a good
She's sitting in
Adora.
For John Hockenberry today. And we're also following the takeaways Andrea Bernstein as she goes from swing state to hear from voters as a run-up to the Democratic convention, which begins in Colorado on Monday. And we want to hear from you about your thoughts. Sally says to us, she wrote, nice story about the lack of enthusiasm among former Hillary supporters for Barack Obama. She writes, remember when people were worried that the Clintons were damaging the Democratic Party by staying in the race so long and especially by appealing to white voters? Thank you, Sally, for your thoughts. And you can join the conversation at 877-8-MY-TAKE or email us at mytake@thetakeaway.org. And we're going to touch in on some swing states, two of them, this morning. You want to say?
I was just going to say, I have a funny feeling that some Hillary supporters out there are going to want to talk back to Sally.
Well, we'll see.
Okay.
We invite them. We want them to do that. But we're going to take a look in the meantime at two swing states. That's Florida and Virginia. In Florida right now, they're gearing up for congressional primaries, which take place August 26th. Florida has long been dominated by the Republican Party. So this season is really very interesting because the Democrats think they might be able to pick up a few seats. Leslie Clark is the national correspondent for the Miami Herald. She's based in Washington, and she joins us now. Good morning, Leslie.
Hey, good morning.
So the Democrats picked up two congressional seats in 2006, and they've got their eyes on at least five this time around, right?
Yeah, they're definitely eager to try to take off another seat this year.
And what gives them some hope that that might actually be possible?
Well, they have been on an uptick. Like I said, they got two seats in 2006 from the Republicans, and they also were able to win a statewide elected office, the chief financial officer. They believe some of the polls on the president and other economic factors make it a good year for them.
And what is the presidential polling? What is that looking like right now?
The presidential polling is pretty tight. It doesn't show either one really has a hold on the state.
And what do you think the opening is for Democrats this time around? What's making some of those candidates more attractive than, say, Democrats have been in some time there in Florida?
A lot of it has been the economy. Florida has been really hard hit by the housing crisis, and a lot of the emphasis for the Democrats has been on, do you want more of this, of the way the economy's been run?
Leslie Clark, I'm going to ask you to hold on for a minute because we're going to bring Jeff Shapiro into this conversation. He's a political reporter and columnist for the Richmond Times-Dispatch and a weekly political commentator on WCVE, the Richmond Public Radio Station. Welcome, Jeff. And you have some interesting races going on there, too, in Virginia, which has, in modern history, been a pretty conservative, Republican kind of presidential state.
Yes, to the outside world, this would seem to be a Republican redoubt, but the Democrats have been clawing their way back and steadily since 2001. There are two congressional races that are generating a good deal of interest. Virginia 11 in the Washington suburbs, that's an open seat. Tom Davis, moderate Republican, is retiring. He famously said that if the Republican brand were dog food, it would be taken off of the grocery store
right,
shelves.
Right, yes, yes.
Again, you know, lamenting quite publicly the difficulties that the party faces. That is expected to be a Democratic pickup. Virginia 2 in southeastern Virginia, it includes the resort city of Virginia Beach. It is also a contested seat. It's held by a Republican, a very resourceful, hard-working, blue-collar Republican, but the Democrats think they may have a shot down there as well.
And really one of the high-profile races is the seat Republican John Warner's received. He's retiring after almost 30 years in the Senate, and this has been a very famous and notorious run, more in his personal life than for his political endeavors. But former Democratic Governor Mark Warner is leading in the polls to take his place.
Yes, and that looks like a very, very easy pickup for the Democrats at this point. Mark Warner running against a former governor as well, Jim Gilmore, who the Democrats depict as essentially ruining the state's finances. Governor Gilmore is a very aggressive, go-for-the-throat sort of politician, and with a little bit of money, and he doesn't have much, he might be able to make this a much more competitive race. But that Senate campaign is interesting in another respect. A lot of folks down here are wondering whether we will see reverse coattails. Warner, who has a very broad bipartisan base, may be able to help Senator Obama Obama here in Virginia.
And also, it can't hurt Senator Obama that Virginia's Governor Tim Kaine has been talked about widely as a possible VP pick for Obama.
Governor Kaine, among the first figures of consequence in the South to endorse Senator Obama, roughly 7 days after Senator Obama declared his candidacy. Governor Kaine is a national co-chair. He's been very active in Senator Obama's behalf, and we're expecting the senator in here tomorrow.
Okay, so a tight race there in Virginia. Leslie Clark?
Yeah, we had John McCain in Florida yesterday speaking to the VFW in Orlando, and then we've got Barack Obama there this morning speaking to the same group, weathering Tropical Storm Fay conditions as he lands in Orlando this morning. So they're definitely fighting it out for the state.
Leslie Clark, many thanks to you. Leslie is the national correspondent for the Miami Herald. She's based in Washington. And also thanks to Jeff Shapiro, political reporter and columnist for the Richmond Times-Dispatch and a weekly political commentator on WCVE, the Richmond, Virginia's public radio station. And now we turn to Femi Okeh, who has some headlines for us.
Thank you very much. 28 minutes past the hour. As NATO politicians gathered earlier today in Brussels to discuss how to treat Russia after its invasion of Georgia, Russia's deputy ambassador to NATO, Ivan Soltanovsky, sent them a message.
Cool down, take an objective assessment of the situation, and think twice before taking any decisions concerning our partnership within the framework of NATO-Russia Council.
Britain's Foreign Secretary David Miliband had an equally stern message for Russia.
I think we should ensure that we engage with Russia in a hard-headed way, but also doesn't play into the Russian penchant for a sense of victimhood. And we must not make Russia the victims of this affair. They are actually the transgressors.
There are reports that Russian troops have blockaded the town of Poti and are arresting Georgian soldiers in direct contravention of the ceasefire. International forces in Afghanistan suffered their biggest loss in more than 3 years. 10 French troops are dead after a two-day firefight with Taliban militants outside of Kabul. Some new numbers in from the economic front. Wholesale inflation surged in July, leaving prices for the past year rising at the fastest pace in 27 years. And the construction of homes and apartments fell in July to the lowest level in more than 17 years. And finally, Tropical Storm Fay is on land and may dump up to 10 inches of rain on southern Florida. Schools, government offices and many businesses are closed today, and there's still some heavy rain in the forecast.
Thanks, Femi.
The Takeaway is supported by the Bill and Melinda Gates Foundation, dedicated to the idea that all people deserve the chance to live a healthy, productive life. Information at gatesfoundation.org. And by the Henry Luce Foundation for increased understanding of East and Southeast Asia.
The Takeaway is made possible by Liberty Mutual's Responsibility Project, featuring stories of responsible acts that happen every day. Stories to read, share, and respond to available at responsibilityproject.com. Because one responsible act can make an unforgettable difference.
You're listening to The Takeaway with John Hockenberry and Adora Udoji.
Good morning. It's Tuesday, August 19th. I'm Catherine Land for in for John Hockenberry. Last week, two young men died in two different war zones. They were both soldiers, true, but they had more than that in common. They were both from the Cape Cod community of Mashpee, Massachusetts, a town of some 14,000 people. 21-year-old Army Private First Class Paul Conlon was killed Friday in a roadside bomb attack in Afghanistan. The day before, Marine Private First Class Daniel McGuire was killed while on patrol in Fallujah, Iraq. Now, Mashpee has lost soldiers before, but the double hit of losing two boys is tough. Last night, there was a candlelight vigil. Here's a friend. His name is Brian West, talking about the impact of the deaths.
It's really devastated us as a town because we're such a small town and everybody knows everybody, and it's one of those things. And I don't know how the town will do after time.
Sean Corcoran is a senior reporter at WCAI, the Cape and Islands National Public Radio Station on Cape Cod. Sean, you were in Mashpee yesterday, and you were at the vigil. What can you tell us?
Well, there were about 500 people there, and it was a very moving experience, I think, particularly for the young people, the generation, the contemporaries of these two soldiers who went to high school within 3 years of each other and graduated within 3 years of each other. And for the young people there, they seemed just absolutely shocked, lots of tears, as you would expect. And the crowd was very large and just, you know, actually flowed onto the street. No one anticipated there would be that many people there.
As I mentioned in our introduction, Mashpee has had people that they have lost in war before. What do you think it is about these two particular deaths that has elicited such a reaction?
I think the fact that they knew so many of the same people because their time at the high school overlapped. They were also, I'm told, very similar in personalities. Both were artists. One was in a play. Daniel McGuire, who was 19, he did a lot of plays, including started playing the Jimmy Stewart role in Harvey, while Paul Conlon was an artist, and he did the posters for some of the theater shows as well. So I think people also found similarities in their personalities in terms of they were both very funny and extroverts, but also could be extremely serious when it came to things that they cared about, in this case, the military.
Now, Sean, just to give a little more detail, here is a little detail that we got from a friend of Paul Conlon's named Andy.
He was just who he was. He always did what he wanted. He always had crazy hair and mohawks, and he just really, he had a great personality. It was really unmatched.
I think it was just the detail about the crazy hair in the mohawks. It's those details that make your heart twist just a bit.
Well, Catherine, last night there were many young people who knew Paul Conlon there, and they wore headbands, which Paul was known to do quite often. And some of them had their hair in mohawks, which Paul did as well, as kind of just shock people and put them off their game. I was told I didn't see too many different colors, but he also colored his hair in different fashions as well. So they were very, very interesting, not cookie-cutter people, that's for certain.
Also, you mentioned how serious they both were about their service. What did you hear about that?
Well, I spent some time with Daniel McGuire's family yesterday, and his father was telling me, Mark McGuire was telling me that since Daniel was a young boy, he wanted to be a soldier. He may not have been able to express it at the age of 8 or 9, but it was certainly something that was there, and it remained with him, and that was probably one of the reasons he found Boy Scouting to be so compelling. And he also told me an interesting story about Daniel. When he was in Scouts, they were supposed to do a 5-mile day hike through some local woods, and they were just going to wear small backpacks. But Daniel, that wasn't good enough. He went downstairs to the weight bench and got some plates off the weight bench to put in his pack so they'd be heavier for him. And that he was just a very driven person, and the same is, I'm told, of Paul.
Now, we have some tape of a conversation that you had with Mark McGuire, the father of Daniel. Let's go ahead and listen to it.
Daniel's last words to me were, "I love you." They very well should have been, "You're welcome." And, you know, for the rest of my days, I'll be thanking my son for his service. And, you know, and beyond Daniel, Paul Conlon and anybody else serving in that capacity, you know, we owe them a huge debt.
Sean, that's from a conversation you had with Mark McGuire. What else can you tell us about that conversation?
Well, Daniel had four younger brothers, and they're certainly trying to sort this out. The family, Daniel had gone through what his parents called a rebellious period not long before he left for boot camp, but and also before he left for Iraq. But they had reconciled. The week before he went to Iraq, the family was all together, and it was so joyous, I understand, for particularly his youngest brother, his 13-year-old brother, who thanked God. They're a very religious family, who thanked God for reconciling their family. And they also told me that Daniel spoke to each one of them on the phone a week before he was killed, and each he said, "I love you," to each one. That was his final words to every member of his family.
Sean Corcoran, thank you so much. Sean is a reporter for the Cape and Islands National Public Radio stations. We're going to turn now to Femi Oke, who has the latest headlines for us. Hey, Femi.
Hello there, Catherine. Coming up to 21 minutes to the top of the hour. NATO allies say they can't have normal relations with Russia as long as Moscow has troops in Georgia. Secretary of State Condoleezza Rice and her 25 NATO counterparts have called on Russia to immediately withdraw its troops from Georgia. President Saakashvili of Georgia says there can be no peace with Russia until the troops leave.
We are suffering every day, every hour, every minute of this aggression. But I will be the first one to say, even if we are suffering, there is no way you can compromise with these kind of things unless they leave.
That was President Saakashvili of Georgia speaking outside of a mass in Tbilisi. Meanwhile, Russian tanks and armored vehicles are on the road again in Georgia, moving out of the key city of Gori. But reports from the port city of Poti indicate that Russian troops aren't leaving and are arresting Georgian soldiers. The government says that inflation surged in July. The Labour Department reports that prices at the wholesale level shot up 1.2%. And the Commerce Department announced this morning that new home construction dropped to its lowest level in 17 years last month. A French official says that Zambia's president has died. That's Levi Mwanawasa, age 59. The statement from the French president's office didn't say how, when, or where the Zambian leader had died, but he has been hospitalized in France since he suffered a stroke in June. That was also the time when, very unfortunately, the international media said he had died in June and he was still suffering from a stroke in hospital. But that's President Mwanawasa of Zambia, dead at 59.
Thanks, Femi.
The Takeaway is made possible by Liberty Mutual's Responsibility Project, encouraging discussion about what it means to do the right thing. ResponsibilityProject.com.
It is Tuesday, August 19th. Good morning. I'm Catherine Lanfer in for John Hockenberry.
Hi, Catherine, and I'm Adora Udoji. And the Emmys this year, Catherine, are getting viewers involved, you know, because we've been talking about this. And it's really an easy one because essentially they're asking people for their favorite moments in a television drama or comedy. We're not talking about ones that are award-winning or ones that have won Emmys, but moments that you remember that moved you in some way, or you sat around the water cooler talking about the next day, because the Television Academy is compiling a list of 40 of those moments, and we thought we'd get some ideas going early and ask for years. Here's a start. You remember Arnold?
You talking about?
Oh, the good old days. No. That's Different Strokes. And of course, Catherine, I think there's some, what was that line from Alice, the show with Florence, Jean Castleberry?
I've got it. Kiss my grits.
Yeah, that's it. That's it. That's it. But these days, people think more, talk about, you know, cultural trends. I mean, what an icon, Sex and the City. It's off the air now. But, of course, there are some moments that many remember from it.
Right, someone say something not sentimental.
Chemo might have kicked me into early menopause.
Task accomplished.
You cannot believe the hot flashes. I can barely keep my clothes on.
Really? What was your excuse before the chemo?
What was her excuse before the chemo? Well, that was a question, right? Sex in the City, as I'm sure we could guess. However, a cultural trend there. But there's also some dark humor sometimes that brought on a few laughs. Let's take a listen to a bit of Taxi.
Courtrooms give me the willies. I had to go to court myself once a few years back.
Really? Did they get you on drugs?
No, I was already on drugs.
You forget Tony Danza and Christopher Lloyd there.
Now, I've got one for you. You might not remember this particular moment, but it gave rise to a phrase that is part of the common parlance now, jumping the shark. This is from Happy Days.
Look at that shark, Potts.
Yeah.
How could you accept the challenge?
It wasn't me, it was you.
I know.
It's okay.
I think that was the Fonz clearing the shark. You know, whenever...
I don't remember that.
Whenever... I don't remember the moment, but...
I don't remember anyone ever saying jumping the shark.
Just Google it. Anytime, any kind of movie, any kind of TV series, any kind of political campaign hits a moment that is so completely unbelievable, you know that they are going to any lengths to grab your attention. Never, unlike this show. They've jumped the shark.
Well, I did look it up on Google, like you said, and on Wikipedia, jumping the shark is a colloquialism used by U.S. TV critics and fans to denote that point in a TV show or movie series history when the plot veers off into a ridiculous storyline or out of the ordinary
characterization. Now, TV fans and critics, you know who TV fans and critics are? Everyone listening to this show
right now. Which is why don't let us have the final say. We want to hear some of your favorite TV moments from dramedies and from comedies. Give us a call, 877-8-MY-TAKE, or go to the website, then drop us a note at mytake@thetakeaway.org. We know you have an opinion on some of these.
Just don't jump the shark.
Just don't jump the shark. Now I know. The things you learn on this show.
Yeah, kind of amazing, huh?
Today's conversation on The Takeaway is supported by Liberty Mutual, dedicated to celebrating personal responsibility and to proving its own with a comprehensive array of home, auto, and life insurance products. More information at libertymutual.com or 1-800-4-LIBERTY. Responsibility, what's your policy?
You're listening to The Takeaway with John Hockenberry and Adora Udoji from Public Radio International and WNYC in collaboration with the BBC World Service, The New York Times, and WGBH Radio Boston.
Good morning. I'm Catherine Lanfer in for John Hockenberry. Road trip. We're taking one with our political director, Andrea Bernstein, as she travels to the Democratic National Convention in Denver. She's been talking to voters in swing states. And today we heard from former Clinton supporters who say they're not quite sure they can bear to vote for Barack Obama. Now, in response, we got this from John on our website. I have always assumed that most supporters of Hillary Clinton are pro-choice. If they cannot overcome their disappointment at her loss of the Democratic nomination and either stay home or vote for McCain, that means that McCain may be the one who picks the replacements for John Paul Stevens and Ruth Bader Ginsburg. Okay, we know you might have a response to that, so go ahead, go to our website, thetakeaway.org, so you can follow Andrea's trip and be a part of this conversation. Now we're going to go to a conversation about the news. Femi Okeh's here.
Thank you very much, Catherine. Coming up to 12 minutes to the hour, after an emergency meeting in Brussels today, NATO ministers say it won't be business as usual as long as Russia has troops inside Georgia. Secretary of State Condoleezza Rice and her 25 NATO counterparts are calling on the Kremlin to withdraw its forces immediately. There are some indications that Moscow has begun a troop withdrawal from the key city of Gori. There's been fierce fighting in Afghanistan today outside the capital, Kabul. French NATO soldiers have been battling pro-Taliban militants for 2 days. Officials say that 10 French soldiers have been killed and more than 20 wounded. And just getting news in of a vehicle explosion in southern Turkish, in a southern Turkish province, killing a suicide bomber and injuring 6 police officers. American gymnast Shawn Johnson finally has her first Olympic gold medal. She won the balance beam today in Beijing. She already has 3 silver medals, so congratulations to her.
Yeah, good for her. Thanks, Femi.
You're welcome.
Catherine?
This
week, political reporters are on high alert. Clearly, I missed my cue there. Sorry, folks. Every cell phone, BlackBerry, and computer is charged up and ready to go.
Wait, was that your phone?
And that's, I know, don't we wish? Because everyone's waiting to see who Senator Barack Obama is going to pick as his running mate. And as of last night, the word was Obama had narrowed his choice to 3 potential candidates. And Adam Nagorny of the New York Times is keeping watch. Welcome, Adam. As always, glad to have you. So what do you know?
What do we know? We know that... Senator Obama is going to be making his announcement probably sometime over the next 4 or 5 days, not today, possibly tomorrow. My guess is Thursday or Friday. we think it's down to three. This is a very closely held decision, and there are not many people who really know what's going on. But all indications are to us that he's taking a look right now at Senator Joe Biden of Delaware, Governor Tim Kaine of Virginia, and Senator Evan Bayh of Indiana.
It's extraordinarily close to the vest. I've heard somewhere along the way that perhaps only as many as five people know who he has chosen.
I think that's right. I think if you include his wife, that might make six. I mean, it's really, you know, I've covered a bunch of these in the past. They tend to be pretty closely held. This one is exceptionally closely held. The Obama campaign takes it as a sort of pledge of accomplishment to try to keep its internal deliberations confidential and out of the press. So I think they're probably enjoying this. But we're getting some stuff out of them, I'm happy to say.
Yeah, you did mention three potential names that have been bandied about for actually a couple of weeks, if
That's
not
correct.
A couple of months. Now, what would they individually bring to Barack Obama? What is his list look like of traits that he needs moving forward?
Well, there's three things that he arguably needs. One is he needs somebody to sort of compliment him on the whole idea of foreign affairs and experience. Two, he needs someone who sort of emphasizes his message of change, different, we're going to change the way things are done in Washington, someone from outside of Washington. And third, it would be nice to have someone who could deliver one of the states that the Obama people are trying to put in play. Unfortunately, there's no one out there that kind of fits all three or even two of them.
I was going to say, and in fact, Senator Joe Biden might, in fact, negate two or three of those. He is a Washington insider. He does have a lot of foreign policy, but delivering Delaware is not exactly the most significant of all of the states, doesn't have the high number of electoral votes that Obama is going to need to march towards a winning total.
Yeah, I think you're exactly right about that. And I think that if he picks Senator Biden, which is, I think, very possible, it's going to mean that he's decided that the most important factor for him was foreign policy credentials, which makes sense considering what's going on in the world right now. That doesn't seem so crazy to me. If you pick a guy like Kaine, my guess is probably 10% of the listeners to this program have even really heard of him before. You get the idea of someone who is changed and different, and he puts the state in play. But the problem with him is he doesn't really have any experience at all in Washington foreign affairs, and there's a risk, I think, that he might sort of underline what is Senator Obama's biggest weakness here. At least Senator Bayh, Indiana, you know, Indiana is a state that the Obama campaign would like to put in play. He is a member of the Washington establishment, but he's also, you know, he's been a governor, he's been a senator, and he has foreign policy experience. One caveat, part of his foreign policy experience was being one of the biggest advocates of the war in Iraq, which could be problematic considering the way Senator Obama's been running.
Or it could be an advantage, this is Catherine Lanford, trying to get back to some of those Hillary supporters as well.
Maybe. I don't think, though, that I don't think it would be an advantage in terms of the war, because I don't think that's a cutting issue for Hillary Clinton supporters. I do think it would be helpful because Senator Bayh was one of Mrs. Clinton's biggest supporters. So it would be viewed to some extent, I think, as an olive branch to that campaign. I don't think, from everything I hear, that is one of their major factors. It's something they're thinking about, but that's not one of the major factors they're taking into account and trying to figure out who they want as their running mate.
Look, Adam, you've been doing this for a long time, and one of the things that you see over and over again this election cycle is people are really looking forward to seeing who this VP nominee is. In fact, our political takeaway director, Andrea Bernstein, has been on the road, and many voters telling her, she's in Ohio now, she was in Pennsylvania yesterday, that might actually help them decide who to vote for.
That's interesting. You know, historically, VP candidates have not really made a difference.
Exactly.
You know, we pay all this attention to this stuff, but in the end, I mean, take a look at it, right? You could argue the last one who really made a difference was LBJ in 1960. I did not cover that, just for the record. he delivered Texas. There's some people who say that Gore might have helped Clinton because of that kind of chemistry between them, but beyond that, you know, did Edwards help Kerry? I don't think so. The worst vice presidential, arguably the worst vice presidential selection of the past 40 years was Dan Quayle in 1988. George Bush still won that election. So, I mean, the one kind of reality check here is that people make their decisions based on who is at the top of the ticket. And I think vice presidential choices can hurt, maybe help a little bit in the margins. But when we get to Election Day, people are going to make their choice between Barack Obama and Senator John McCain.
No, but that's what my question was, though, to you, Adam. Is this a different year, coming on the tails of Dick Cheney, who's been, or really, Al Gore, he was a strong vice president. And then you have Dick Cheney, a strong vice president. And then right now, we have two presidential nominees who members of the respective parties have serious issues with some of the traits of the candidate, or their strengths, I should say. Does that push up the importance of the VP nominee?
You know, I think if it does, it's more likely to do not on the Obama side, because there's still stark differences in issues between Obama and McCain, but on the McCain side, mainly because, with all due respect to Senator McCain, he's 71 years old, he's going to be 72 if he's elected president, and people are really good, I think, pay more attention to who he chooses just as a matter of mortality. I think that, you know, people might get reassured who have concerns about Obama, but in the end, you know, core Democratic voters who are now saying they will not vote for Obama, I think, or are having hesitations, I think will be more likely swayed by, say, what John McCain said at the church meeting in California on Saturday, in terms of abortion and the kind of judges he would support, and just mm-hmm. the sort of conservative social views, than on who Barack Obama picks as his vice president.
I have one very quick question
yeah.
for you. We've been asking folks all week, if they were in the Olympics, what would they win a gold medal for? Or not in the Olympics, what would you get a gold, silver, or bronze for, Adam? We're curious.
Cooking.
Oh, really? This is this? Good to know.
We'll be over at 7.
We'll be over.
How about for evading questions?
Yeah. We'll give you 2 golds for that. Your colleague, Bill Carter, said he gets the gold for riding in traffic, but we like your answer better. Thanks, Adam.
Take care.
Adam Nagorny reports for the New York Times. Maybe we should start calling him Adam Funny Nagorny.
Or the
funny.
Magic Chef.
Yes.
We're always on
right,
here at the Takeaway.
Right.
I want to remind you, you can catch up with us on Facebook, Friend Feed, Twitter. Today we're following several stories about how NATO might try to resolve the conflict between Russia and Georgia and what voters are thinking about in Pennsylvania.
And we're going on a campaign road trip. Takeaway political director Andrea Bernstein and our web producer Adam Hirsch are on the road, and we're following their trip, not only on the show, but you can see what they're up to online.
And here is today's takeaway.
You could argue the last one who really made a difference was LBJ in 1960. I did not cover that, just for the record.
Just for the record, you just heard from him. That was New York Times reporter Adam Nagorny talking about the vice presidency and how important it really will be when we finally find out who Barack Obama is going to pick.
Don't forget the Veep Stakes.
Yes, and that is, you can connect to it on our website at thetakeaway.org.
I'm Catherine Lanfer, in for John Hockenberry.
And I'm Adora Udoji, and you're listening to The Takeaway.
The Takeaway is supported by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting, the John S. and James L. Knight Foundation, advancing journalistic excellence in the digital age. More information at knightfoundation.org. And by the Rockefeller Foundation and its Campaign for American Workers. More at rockfound.org. This is The Takeaway.
I'm David Remnick, host of the New Yorker Radio Hour. There's nothing like finding a story you can really sink into that lets you tune out the noise and focus on what matters. In print or here on the podcast, the New Yorker brings you thoughtfulness and depth and even humor that you can't find anywhere else. So please join me every week for the New Yorker Radio Hour, wherever you listen to podcasts.